opening up the rooms to code would I think would be a really a positive step forward for the people that are here, the people that are on a road to recovery.
Code violations, from leaky ceilings to pests, are difficult to address in low-income housing in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state promotes TransCanada's participation in the new gas line deal.
We think that this particular partnership is in the state's interest and will provide value to Alaskans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
An Alaska-based paratrooper has died after collapsing following a jump. U.S. Army Alaska officials say in a release that the soldier died last night at Providence, Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage. The statement says there is no indication the soldier had a hard landing or that there was equipment failure during the parachute jump he completed prior to collapsing. The Army says the soldier's parachute had been packed away and he was wearing his rucksack when the drop zone safety officer reached him. He was rushed to the Anchorage Hospital and underwent emergency surgery, but was pronounced dead just after 8 p.m. The Big Timber Motel in Anchorage has been in the news recently because of health and safety concerns, everything from fire code violations to an infestation of bed bugs. But it's not the only low-income housing in Anchorage with problems, and city officials say it's difficult to address the issue. KSKA's Daisy Eaton has the story.
48-year-old Cassie Lee Lewis shares a small room with her gray cat at the Mush Inn on the outskirts of downtown Anchorage. On a recent morning, she's just finished airing out her clothes and bedding. It's something she has to do daily to keep the bugs at bay. She points to the bed.
I just got done going through my clothes in my bed to make sure that the bed bugs were all killed and off. And I do it every day, and I do kill cockroaches every day.
She says they've been a problem since she moved into the room in October from Brother Francis' shelter. Even though she works to keep the bed bugs out, she says they crawl in from a neighboring room through a gap around a pipe under her sink, and they make her feel bad.
It's kind of disgusting, and it makes me feel, I mean, you can see on my face, they bite my face, they bite my arms and my legs and stuff, so it's a bummer. It makes me think of those women and children in Africa with flies all over their bodies when it happens to me.
Besides problems with pests, Lewis shows me a place on the ceiling where water is leaking. But the rent of $8.50 a month is all she can afford. Closer to downtown, David, who asked that we only use his first name, sits beside cages holding tropical birds in the lobby of Henry House, a transitional living facility.
So the birds are cheery, but the rooms aren't.
Yeah.
Henry House is a for-profit motel for men that has agreements with state agencies to provide housing for people coming out of the mental health court, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and the Department of Corrections, among others. They rent simple dorm rooms for around $750 a month and serve tenants one meal a day. Women are not allowed in the rooms, but David shared photos of his room on his cell phone in the lobby.
I was really surprised when I went into the bathroom and I saw a hole on the floor, and there's also a hole in the drywall.
David thinks the rooms should be fixed.
Bringing up the rooms to code would be a really a positive step forward for the people that are here, the people that are on a road to recovery, or the people that are dealing with long-term mental disabilities.
The owners of Henry House, Kathy and Bob Henry, did not agree to a recorded interview, but they admit that tenants have damaged rooms and that they have trouble keeping up with maintenance. The oversight of motels in Anchorage is not the responsibility of any one department or office. Instead, several departments monitor them. Some departments, like fire, inspect annually, but others, like building and health, only check things out if they receive a complaint.
You've reached the code violation hotline.
Anchorage Municipal Building Official Sharon Walsh says the problems at Henry House and the Mush Inn can be reported to a hotline at the city's Land Use Enforcement Office.
Anything having to do with what they call vectors, you know, vermin, cockroaches, rats, that will go to the health department. And then the ones that are more building maintenance related, they'll go inspect and determine what needs to be done.
Over at the Municipal Department of Health and Human Services, Deputy Director Steve Morris says his environmental health section handles pests.
Their primary responsibility is inspection of food facilities and that sort of thing. But they also enforce a part of Title 15, which has to do with housing.
And motels. But Morris says the code is at least 30 years old, and there's no regular inspection for pests. Andy says the inspectors are already overworked.
I can tell you that if we were to get hundreds of bed bug complaints, we would not be able to satisfactorily address them. They're just not the resources currently available to do that.
To really address the issue of bed bugs, Morris says staffing levels and the municipal code would need to be addressed. Back at Henry House, David says he hasn't seen any pests in his room, but he's reported the damage in his room to the owners. As of Friday, nothing's been fixed. At the Mush Inn, Lewis says she's reported the leaking, cockroaches, and bedbugs in her room to the manager's office, but nothing's been done. She's on the waiting list for an apartment through Cook Inlet Housing, but for now, she's keeping up her routines.
Sometimes I kill them in the bathroom and I kill them in the living room. I try to kill them.
Down the road near Merrill Field, many of the two dozen residents of the Big Timber Motel, which was seized by the city after the owner didn't pay taxes, are still living there. Problems at the motel include fire code violations and bedbug and mice infestations. The municipality is considering condemning the building. So far, they've spent around $40,000 on upgrades and paying back bills so that residents can have hot water and heat again. They are not charging residents rent at this time. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
An increase in complaints from Alaskans about the U.S. Postal Service prompted Senator Mark Begich to write the Postmaster General this week, demanding answers. Several dozen Alaskans unhappy about mail service have contacted Begich over the past 2 months, a spokeswoman says. Their objections include longer routing for Ketchikan letters and delays in bypass mail that Begich says have resulted in groceries arriving rotten. Andy says Alaskans have been told they have to ship boxes by expensive priority mail because parcel post is no longer an option. Ernie Swanson, a postal spokesman for the Alaska region, says the option hasn't gone away. It's just no longer the lowest rate.
We still have parcel post in certain situations, but priority mail is at least about the same price, if not better, in certain weight categories.
A nationwide rate hike went into effect Sunday, and the Postal Service earlier changed the name of Parcel Post to Standard Post. Swanson confirmed that all first-class letters from Ketchikan are routed through Juneau now, even those headed just across town in Ketchikan. Swanson says the problem is that Ketchikan's 30-year-old postmarking machine broke down and parts are unavailable.
To put another machine in there was out of the question because the new machines simply have a footprint that's too large to fit into the Ketchikan post office.
He says with 3,000 letters a day, hand stamping the Ketchikan mail isn't possible either. But Swanson says letters across Ketchikan are still arriving the next day, barring weather delays. Begich's office says he hasn't yet received an official response from the Postmaster General, but they expect one next week. U.S. Senator Mark Begich reported bringing in nearly $850,000 toward his re-election effort during the final quarter of 2013. Begich's campaign, in a filing with the Federal Election Commission, reported ending the year with $2.8 million on hand. The contributions from October through December include nearly $530,000 from individuals and about $280,000 from political committees. Two of Begich's Republican rivals had released fundraising totals for the quarter but had not yet released their reports. Mead Treadwell's campaign reported raising more than $228,000, while Dan Sullivan reported bringing in more than $1.2 million. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a card game takes hold among teenage boys in Unalaska.
They practice communication skills and, you know, really how to problem solve with each other. You know, not only is it an intelligent game, but it's a social activity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska's public schools have new standards in English and math, setting high expectations for students. Students who meet these goals will be ready for success after high school, whether in the military, on the job, or in an apprenticeship, technical school, or college. Ask your school for parent guides to the standards or learn more online at education.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
A bill that would reject pay raises for the governor and his commissioners is on track to get a vote in the Senate. The Senate Finance Committee advanced the bill today. The pay raise recommendations come from a nonpartisan board that look at factors like cost of living and salaries for comparable positions in other states. Finance co-chair Kevin Meyer acknowledged he would like to accept the recommendations, but
I think the timing is not good when we're in deficit spending here.
Governor Sean Parnell has already said he would reject an increase to his own salary. If the commissioner's pay raise recommendations were to go through, the cost of the raises would be upwards of $200,000. The gas line deal that was brokered earlier this month had signatures from more than a half dozen parties, but one party to the agreement confused some lawmakers, like Senator Hollis French.
In the building, people are asking, why TransCanada?
TransCanada was a key player in Sarah Palin's effort to build a gas line, and legislators from both parties have expressed concern that the company is just a holdover from that attempt. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that Parnell administration officials are responding by making a case for the pipeline builders.
Since the Palin administration, the state has paid out hundreds of millions of dollars to TransCanada as reimbursement for planning work on a gas line. And during that time, things went bad. Instead of signing on to the project, ConocoPhillips and BP made their own failed effort to build a pipeline. When the state-sponsored project went through an open season, it couldn't find any customers. The Lower 48 shale boom meant it was no longer economic to route the line through Canada. Because of all that history, TransCanada's continued involvement in the new proposal has caused some lawmakers to feel a bit of deja vu. At a Senate Resources Committee hearing this week, Anchorage Democrat Hollis French wanted the administration to lay out how this new arrangement differed from the terms of the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act.
Is this like AGIA 2.0, or what is this?
Under AGIA, TransCanada was licensed to basically advance a project on Alaska's behalf. The Parnell administration is now pursuing what they're describing as a more traditional commercial agreement, where the state and the North Slope producers are partners in a project with roughly similar ownership shares. But because the project is expected to cost at least $45 billion, it would be a squeeze for Alaska to cover a quarter of that. That's where TransCanada comes in again, says Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash.
We think that this particular partnership is in the state's interest and will provide value to Alaskans independent of AGIA considerations.
In addition to doing the physical work of constructing the gas line, TransCanada has made a deal with the administration to shoulder a good chunk of the project costs in exchange for a cut of the state's equity. State consultants estimate that the state would have to pay $11 billion to take on an ownership role if TransCanada isn't involved. If they are involved, the cost to the state is halved.
What we're trying to show here is that competition for dollars in this next decade, if we go alone, without a partner, we're going to have some water to carry.
On the money-making side of the balance sheet, the dollar amount the state would take in would be about the same whether TransCanada's sharing the profits or not, according to the administration's projections. That's because in this scenario, the state's earning income by investing the billions of dollars it didn't have to spend on the project, which should cancel out the payments to TransCanada. Balash says another reason for keeping TransCanada involved is that they know how to build pipelines in rough terrain.
If you take a look at where they got their start in the Canadian Rockies, they're familiar with constructing in discontinuous permafrost and mountainous areas. And that's experience I think we want to have employed in this particular project.
Still, senators on the committee had reservations. Peter Michicki, a Republican from Soldotna, wanted to know why the state isn't putting the partnership arrangement out to bid, in case other companies might be interested. Eagle River Republican Fred Dyson asked if TransCanada's involvement with competing pipeline projects in North America might create problems.
Somebody's going to win the horse race, and I hear you almost saying, we don't care. Whichever one does it, we're there to perform for that.
TransCanada executive Tony Palmer stressed that the Alaska project is important to them, and their involvement with other gas line plans is the nature of their business.
That's what we do. We build pipeline projects, build, own, operate them across North America. We own 10,000 miles of pipeline in the United States, and we own 30,000 miles of gas pipeline in Canada.
There's also one more big reason TransCanada is still part of the new gas line arrangement. They were part of the old one. If TransCanada had been cut out, the state would have been at risk of violating their contract. This way, the two parties avoid going to court. So, while the new plan might not exactly be a GIA 2.0, it's definitely shaped by it. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
State prosecutors today dismissed the case against a former Dillingham High School assistant wrestling coach who had been accused of having sexual contact with a 15-year-old female student. 24-year-old Wes Richard was arrested last October after Dillingham police investigated the allegations. In a brief statement, the DA's office said that though they believed there had been probable cause for the arrest, there was not enough evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. With the state's charge dismissed, Richard's attorney, Myron Angstman from Bethel, said he hopes his client can now be exonerated by the public as well. Angstman says he's concerned that the police and prosecution brought such a serious charge without having the evidence to back it up.
When there are so many problems with a case as this, it should not have been brought until the police found out if there are facts to support some of the things they allege.
Richard had been working as an assistant wrestling coach and substitute teacher at Dillingham High School only since August. The school district placed him on administrative leave while the charge was being investigated and fired him the day of his October arrest.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Electronic health records give doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where it's needed most. If it's providing a new doctor access to your child's medical history or taking a loved one to the emergency room, electronic health records provide safe, secure, life-saving information on the spot. For more information, go to ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, magic. For more than 20 years, people all over the world have been playing the strategic fantasy card game Magic: The Gathering. But the game has only recently found its way to Unalaska, where the island's teenage boys have been going through a serious magic phase for the past few months. For the city's recreation staff, that means the chance to offer a Lower 48 style experience, an official magic tournament, which they hosted earlier this month. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has the story.
By Unalaska standards, high school senior Kay Kawada is a Magic the Gathering veteran. He's been playing for 8 months, more than double most of the rest of the boys in today's tournament. When Kay walks into the multi-purpose room precisely 1 minute late while the rules are being explained, the others aren't too happy to see him.
Nobody wanted you to show up.
Kay and 17 other friends and rivals are in for a grueling 5 hours of strategizing, spellcasting, and card shuffling. All these boys are in middle school and high school.
So we're playing Legacy format, which is basically every card ever invented.
That's referee Carlos Tayag explaining how the game is going to work. Magic is the original dueling trading card game invented in Renton, Washington in 1993 and still based there today. There are thousands of cards, all with fantastical illustrations and names like Kamal Pit Fighter. Players use them to attack each other and defend themselves in games. Tayag has been playing Magic for 10 years. He's also been the youth programs coordinator for the City Department of Parks, Culture, and Recreation since October.
It's probably been going heavily here for about 6 weeks that I've noticed, but I've heard that there are underground societies on the island where they've been playing Magic for longer.
Full disclosure, Tayag and I are roommates, and he's even gotten me dabbling in Magic. But I'm only watching and learning today.
One more thing. The youngest player chooses who goes first.
Yes!
In this round.
Round one is about to begin. Everyone shuffles their decks, draws their hands, and gets their game faces on. Tayag starts the clock, and then it gets serious. Soon all around, I'm hearing things like this.
Cradle of Vitality. Whenever I gain life, I may pay one planes and any uncolored mana. And if I do, I can put a 1/1 counter on a target creature for each life I gain.
Complicated? Definitely. But the basics of the game are simple. Each card is a spell, creatures, enchantments, and more. They all cost a certain number of different colored mana cards. You have to put those cards down before you can play anything else. Players use spells to deal damage to each other or block attacks. You start with 20 points each and try to knock each other down to zero. Players have to buy the cards to build their decks. You can spend a little or a lot of money, and you could make a deck that was pretty hard to beat. But there's no card shop in Onalaska, so players buy cards online and barter with friends. It's basically a big trump game, and Tayag says a learning experience.
They practice communication skills and, you know, really how to problem solve with each other. You have to decipher rules, and they kind of get to figure out, you know, what works, how, and why does it work, and why does one person win over the other.
So far, Kay Kawada seems to have a good sense of that. He's victorious after round one.
It's all about dealing damage. I like it.
But Kay's a little nervous. Now everyone wants to beat him. Over the next two rounds, he has to be merciless, even taking out his little brother, Du. Across the room, another younger player is climbing the ranks. Johnny Kongsuk, an 8th grader, has only been playing Magic for a month or so. I asked him about his strategy before round one.
Like, be a pain and just, like, make tap his creatures and then, like, attack when he has nothing to defend with.
Johnny makes it through to the final, and so does Kay. It's going on 9 p.m., and the room has emptied out by the time the championship match begins. Soon, both boys are wiping sweat off their brows. This is one of the most intense games they've ever played. Johnny pulls a spell he hasn't used before. It lets him steal some of Kay's cards.
Dang, he's just using all my creatures.
Using your own creatures against you.
Good.
But soon enough, Kay's back on top, and Johnny can't pull out the win. Kay defeats him. His championship prize, a big box of new Magic cards. The community center plans to hold a Magic workshop in February and maybe more tournaments later in the year. Carlos Tayag isn't sure how long the Magic craze can last here as players graduate and get interested in other things, but he hopes it'll have some staying power.
You know, not only is it an intelligent game, but it's a social activity. I'd much rather have kids playing card games in the community center than playing some other type of game over their video game system, and they're not really kind of connecting with the real world.
And that social interaction holds true even if kids are playing in one of those so-called underground societies, maybe at Johnny's house next weekend. In Onalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the tiny community of Lake Minchumina in interior Alaska.
My name is Charles Draper. Town is Lake Minchumina, Alaska. Very centered geographically of the state. And we have a good view of Denali and the Alaska Range. This winter, there's 12 full-time residents. Well, we're not really in the mountains, but we have mountain weather due to the close, you know, range. We're about 75, 80 miles from Denali. And we have a lot in common with the Denali National Park as far as scenery and wildlife. We're not in the park, we're on the border of the preserve. So we got wolves and fox and lynx and marten and beaver trappers here. We've got a male plane twice a week, and that's mainly when we see each other. we have telephones, and you know, so we, if we want to talk or visit, we usually call before we go over to other people's houses. And we can show up, though. You know, it's not a surprise to have somebody show up to visit or stop by when they're on their way to the trap line or something. You know, it's a lot of work just hauling water and keeping the fire going and cutting wood, and there's time for trapping and exploring and boating in the summer. And the Muddy River leads out of here. It's the main river access, and people can use that to come and go. It's just my kind of ideal lifestyle here.
Charles Draper maintains the local runway, and he volunteers at Lake Minchumina's library. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@aprn.org. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Annie Ropeek, Kristen Platt, and Monica Goki. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Feit. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories, and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.